On the next side in this series, you'll hear a lot of the voices that tried to influence public opinion in one way or another during the late 1930s. But first, here's a man who has staffed for NBC for 40 years, managed to cover some of the most important and dramatic events of our times on radio. It's Ben Grauer.
One of the most memorable broadcasts I ever did was in December 1936. And the world had learned that Baldwin had made the decision for Windsor and that Windsor was going to abdicate. We did it in studios on the third floor, a large studio. And at one end was Frank Black and the NBC Concert Orchestra. They were playing Bach very quietly. My instructions were to listen for the words that would indicate they had switched from BBC control to Windsor Castle. It was 9 o'clock in London, 5 o'clock in New York. And I started at 5, and about a minute after that, the doors opened and half a dozen people came in, weren't supposed to come in, about a dozen of them. They sneaked in. They were Britishers who either worked at NBC or actor or actress. They had their own thoughts, but they wanted to be as close to Britain as they could be at this time. And as I Frank's music was playing, I heard the cue, so I signaled Frank Black down, made my introductory sentence and a half, threw the switch, and precisely at that moment, I think it was Sir John Reith, the head of BBC, said,
"This is Windsor Castle, His Royal Highness Prince Edward.
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own. I have never wanted to withhold anything. But until now, it has not been constitutionally possible for me to speak. But you must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do without the help and support of the woman I love. And now we all have the new king. God bless you all. God save the king."
This is George Hamilton Combs. I'll be back on Side 8.
It's a sad story I bring you from New England today. The Connecticut River is running wild. Late yesterday afternoon, I flew back to New York after an exciting 300-mile flight up and down both sides of the Connecticut Valley, which in some places has taken on the appearance of a vast inland sea on the outer reaches of the...
This is Floyd Gibbons, a real rapid-fire radio reporter of the 1930s.
...barely show above the surface of the rising water. And in the riverbed, the bedstream of the river itself, the normal water course in which ambitious man had hoped to incarcerate Old Man River with dikes and dams of stone and steel, the prisoner is lashing, foaming, writhing, like a serpent striking back...
I'm George Hamilton Combs, and my first year as a commentator on WHN in New York was 1937. In my opinion, that was just the start of radio's most exciting period, when it began to emerge as a real news medium. Early in the 1930s, the radio networks put on a lot of special events, such as competitions between singing mice and bellowing newsboys. I recall one year, NBC built a transmitter into a tall silk hat and sent a reporter out on Fifth Avenue to cover the Easter parade. But apart from all those shenanigans, the networks did develop many reporters with considerable pizzazz and eloquence. Covering for NBC were, among many others, George Hicks and Ben Grauer.
Hicks, myself, several others were sent out on an endless variety of special events, news broadcast, actuality shows. Certainly the most notable and the one that sticks in your memory as a human drama was the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. I got a call to go down to Trenton, New Jersey, the day the news broke that the baby had been kidnapped. I went to the headquarters of the state police of New Jersey. Colonel Norman Schwarzkopf, as I remember, was in charge. This Tuesday evening, about 9 or 10 o'clock, nothing had happened, and so I scurried around and found that the Lindbergh family had given the formula for the baby. So I went on the air about 11 o'clock that night, speaking to the kidnappers wherever they were, which is a dramatic use of broadcasting, and appealing to them to give this formula, and gave them, detailed the formula that the baby should have. Of course, while I was giving that, the baby was lying dead in a shallow grave.
The National Broadcasting Company presents a special bulletin from the Press Radio News. Trenton, New Jersey. Bruno Richard Hauptmann was electrocuted at 8:47 tonight for the murder of the Lindbergh baby. This bulletin is from the Press Radio Bureau. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The Lindbergh case was a real carnival for radio, and it was exhaustively covered. A reporter named Gabriel Heater got a microphone installed right in the sheriff's office, and Gabe Heater spoke for 3 hours and 10 minutes without drawing breath. Back at NBC, the director of news and special events was Abe Schechter, who admits that scooping the opposition played a major part in programming special events.
Those days, covering the White House was wonderful fun, you see. There were very few of us. And everywhere the president went, we went with him. When he went down to Warm Springs, we'd go down and take 2 houses at Warm Springs. And this meant that there were 12, 14 reporters there. And if he was invited to a party, we were invited to a party. And we had a deep, fine, familial relationship. Now, covering the White House is, you know, like covering the market floor down here in Wall Street.
May I present Mr. F.E. Boone, famous tobacco auctioneer.
Remember him? With men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Other rapid-fire talkers sold not tobacco, but ideas, many of them unsound. Radio was a great medium for diatribes and demagogues. Not only was it the greatest stage the world had ever known, it was the greatest soapbox.
They think that you alone is the cause of all their worry. They go gunning for me. And now it is with the PWAs, the GWAs, the NRAs, the AAAs, JUGs, and the GINs, and every other flimsy combination that the country finds its affairs in business tangled where no one can recognize it. There is misery on every hand and corner. But mind you, in the meantime, Mr. Roosevelt has had his way.
Huey Long had not only the Senate and the State House as a platform, but all the radio and press coverage he needed to scare the living daylights out of moderate folk. This next voice was heard over 47 stations and raised millions of dollars, sold thousands of magazines, and aroused a few listeners to extreme acts of violence and anti-Semitism. Many more listeners were shocked and repelled.
We have endeavored to teach you time and again that there can be no coming out of this depression until what you earn goes to sustain your wife and your children. But somehow or other, you're satisfied to sustain the wives and children of those who do the coining and regulating of money, who live in their palaces and travel in their yachts. You want that. You voted for that. You have that. And it's time that you take that.
Good evening. God bless you. You have just listened to a broadcast address delivered by Father Charles Coughlin of Royal Oak, Michigan. Over these same stations, at this same hour, Father Coughlin will have the privilege of addressing you again next Sunday.
The Jurgens Program with Walter Winchell, America's one-man newspaper. Walter Winchell's famous column appears in the New York Daily Mirror and other newspapers from New York to Honolulu. He's here with flash news, odd news, exclusive news. And now to the editorial room of the Jurgens Journal and Walter Winchell.
At this time, I was doing the Winchell Program, which started, I believe, in 1932, and I was with the Winchell for 16 years. And I would say that of all the programs that current at that time, that, with certain ups and downs, was the leading broadcast.
Ben Grauer.
At the height of its popularity, 9 o'clock Sunday night was an absolute ritual for people. They'd stop their bridge, they'd get home from visiting other people. You had to hear that 15 minutes. Heads fell, reputations rolled, Stocks declined, potentates trembled. Winchell's power was so great when he was at his peak.
I don't believe the networks outdid themselves when it came to public service during the 1930s. They saw radio as entertainment and seemed blissfully unaware of radio's power to shape public opinion. Then on October 30th, 1938, broadcasting was badly shaken up by one single show. I mean, of course, The War of the Worlds, starring Orson Welles. When it was over, Mr. Welles had to face the microphones and the cameras.
I'm, of course, surprised that the H.G. Wells classic, which is the original for many fantasies about invasions by mythical monsters from the planet Mars, I'm extremely surprised to learn that a story which has become familiar to children through the medium of comic strips and many succeeding novels and adventure stories should have had such an immediate and profound effect upon radio listeners.
My friends, let us sit down together again, you and I, to consider our own pressing problems that confront us. There are many among us who in the past closed their eyes to events abroad because they believed in utter good faith what some of their fellow Americans told them, that what was taking place in Europe was none of our business. To those who would not admit the possibility of the approaching storm, to all of them, the past 2 weeks have meant the shattering of many...
Well, radio had a tremendous effect, I think, in the development of the country in that decade.
The possibility of the approaching storm, to all of them, the past 2 weeks have meant the shattering of many...
Well, radio had a tremendous effect, I think, in the development of the country in that decade. People were glued to their sets to hear the president really take them into his confidence and tell them what was going on. At least they regarded it in that light.
This is Robert Bendiener, author of An Informal History of the 1930s, just around the corner.
It was exactly the right moment for radio to flourish. You know, here was home entertainment that didn't cost you anything. Not only national entertainment, but in making people for the first time conscious of what was going on in the world. Toward the end of the decade, radio really, I think, converted this country from a traditional isolationism to a feeling of participation in the world. I mean, here you could hear, this is not my idea of pleasure, mind you, but you could hear Adolf Hitler in your living room, and you could hear those horrible roars of the crowd, the Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, and you could hear Mussolini ranting from his balcony, and you could hear Winston Churchill warn his government.
For the Führer, Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil!
Come quasi sempre è avvenuto nelle memorabili adunate del popolo fascista, io parlerò a voi di talune questioni di carattere internazionale.
If ever there was a time when men and women who cherished the ideals of the founders of the British and American constitutions should take earnest counsel with one another, that time is now.
Even way back before that, Ethiopia, we sent people out there, or we would hire newspaper correspondents. For instance, Sun Oil Company had Lowell Thomas. Well, we couldn't send Lowell Thomas out there. He had to be on every night. And we'd pay them, and they'd go on. But of course, when they went on, they would be on right from Addis Ababa, right from the scene of action. And very often, you could hear the bombings.
This again is Abe Schechter.
Then also, we started what we called our shortwave monitoring service. We built a big tower, and we piped in on 15, 18 different receivers, the various countries of the world. And we hired linguists. And most of them could listen to it in German and write it into English or in Italian.
And we kept a monitor on all foreign countries.
That shortwave monitoring system made a lot of headlines before the war. Countless times, the networks scooped every other news service in the world. As 1937 progressed, the suspense over events in Europe and the Far East was almost unbearable. I myself took to the air on WHN in New York to try to warn people that Hitler was a madman who had to be stopped. But often, I had the feeling that my microphone was disconnected and no one was getting the message. And again, John Daly.
Prior to Anschluss in 38 and Germany's investment of Austria, while there were news broadcasts, professional news staffs in the sense that we know them today hardly existed. At that time, for instance, Ed Murrow, who had been director of Talk CBS New York, had changed to European director CBS. This would be, I would think, in 36 or early 37. With his principal function, actually, to arrange, for instance, for the Pope's Easter message to be broadcast to the United States, for the music festivals, etc. It was more a question of special event programming from Europe, as, for instance, my work in Washington was concerned principally with special events. When Anschluss came, as you know, Ed Murrow, frantically looking for staff, found Bill Shira in Spain, where he had been with INS, and sent Shira off to Vienna to cover Anschluss and began to build a European staff, out of which came Savaride, Collingwood, etc. Under the impetus of Anschluss, Paul White, who was the father of CBS News, and I think a man to whom the industry owes a great deal and doesn't quite recognize it, Paul White began to build in CBS the great news staff, which saw it through the war years, and I think took the network to great reputation thereafter.
During the month of the Munich crisis, September of 1937, H.V. Kaltenborn actually slept on a cot at CBS to be ready when the bulletins came in. Finally, this voice was heard. Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
Time marches on.
One of the programs which had a curious blend of studio commercial program presentation and on-the-scene news events was a hybrid and remarkable program was the March of Time series, I think was sponsored by Time magazine. Yes, it was.
Ben Gower.
This was a very serious, carefully put together production. Voorhees, Van Voorhees, Westbrook, with this wonderful ringing crack of doom, March of Time quality, would give the headlines, and I'd do the scene setters. For the actualities. Nothing, of course, was actuality. When you heard Hitler, it wasn't Hitler. When you heard FDR, it wasn't FDR. But there were very skilled actors who could interpret and stylize imitations of these people. I can still hear Bill Adams' voice saying,
I have a somewhat important matter to take up today. I'm sending a message to Congress. Since the earliest days of the Republic, the problem of the personnel of the federal courts has needed the attention of Congress. Modern complexities call for a constant infusion of new blood in the courts.
The reason for this recreation of the news was that any recording played back at a later date was considered far inferior to the original, and it was just not done. Eleanor Roosevelt, too, was featured on the March of Time in the spring of 37 when her autobiography was published.
My mother-in-law thought our house was too small, and she built a house for us. A few weeks after we moved in, Franklin found me weeping and asked me what on earth was the matter. I said I did not like to live in a house which was not in any way mine. And which
I remember particularly one time when we had to give the feeling of a Nazi triumph within Germany, and they were singing the Horst Wessel. Die Fahne hoch, da di 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 ta da tum. What they did was pass out the words in German to the gang. And as I heard this group of 15 or 20 marching in a kind of oval and shuffling feet and singing this thing, it was blood-chilling to me, and I sensed the mystic power of the combination of blood and nationalism and destiny and all of the emotional, neurotic hypodermics that Hitler had been putting into the German bloodstream, because I began to feel a bit of it myself.
This is the March of Time from March 1939, recreating the fall of Czechoslovakia.
The troops of the Third Reich of Adolf Hitler are in Prague, and the Republic of Czechoslovakia is no more.
The Columbia Workshop presents The Fall of the City by Archibald MacLeish.
Ladies and gentlemen, this broadcast comes to you from the city. The world has watched with wonder for 3 days, not for the common occasions of brutal crime, or the usual violence of one sort or another, or coronations of kings or popular festivals. No, but for stranger and disturbing reasons, the resurrection from death in the tomb of a dead woman. Each day for 3 days...
By the spring of 1937, Archibald MacLeish had written The Fall of the City for radio. Irving Reese was producing it for the Columbia Workshop. He had all of the directors on the CBS staff working under him because of the immensity of the production.
This is William Robeson, who took part in this remarkable prophetic radio drama broadcast live on April the 11th, 1937. That was the kind of production of which CBS and all the participants could be justly proud.
He wanted this thing to sound as though it were occurring in an open square in a timeless, placeless city. So he got the armory up in Park Avenue in 60-something. And we emptied the armory of tennis players on a Saturday. We had 1,000 students from NYU for the crowd. That was my responsibility. I was the crowd director. Burgess Meredith was the narrator. Orson Welles was one of the supporting cast. The crowd was a character. The crowd just wasn't roaring and yelling and saying, hey, hey. The crowd was reacting with gasps that had meaning, and this was quite a difficult job. We had to work all day with these people. And we attempted, Irving, of course, was a superb engineer, so he was after acoustical effect and got it. Sunday, the show was on at 7 o'clock Sunday evening. We finished with the dress rehearsal, and we're about, within 20 minutes, 25 minutes of going on the air, when an immense rattle occurs and great doors go up on the Lexington Avenue side of the armory, and in roar tanks and motorized equipment from the National Guardsmen out on maneuvers. We had to go and have the captain park them outside for a half hour.
His arm rises. His visor is opening. There's no one. There's no one at all. No one. The helmet is hollow. The metal is empty. The armor is empty. I tell you, there's no one at all there. There's only the metal, the barrel of metal, the bundle of armor. It's empty. They don't see. They lie on the pavement. They lie in the burnt spears, the ashes of arrows. They lie there. They don't see or they won't see. They are silent. The people invent their oppressors. They wish to believe in them. They wish to be free of their freedom, released from their liberty. The long labor of liberty ended. They lie there. Look, it's his arm. It is rising. His arm's rising. They're watching his arm as it rises. They stir. They cry. They cry out. They are shouting. They're shouting with happiness. Listen. They're shouting like troops in a victory. Listen. The city of masterless men has found a master. You say it was they were the conquerors. They that had conquered.
The
The city is fallen.
You'll be hearing about the last months of peace and the war itself from Gary Moore on The Next Two Sides. This is George Hamilton Combs signing off, or as I used to say, that's the way the world spins.
I have the great honor to present to you the President of the United States. I hereby dedicate the World's Fair, the New York World's Fair, of 1939.
As the scene opens now, we find Amos and Andy in the fresh air taxicab arriving at one of the nine entrances of the New York World's Fair.
Well, here's the gate right up here, now, Andy. And there's a policeman standing there. He looked like the Northwest Mounted, don't he?
Yeah, wait a minute. Maybe we better not go in there. I can see Mr. Whale some other time.
Wait a minute.
Laughter, song, and
Britain went to war against Germany today, 25 years and 30 days from the time she entered the war of 1914 against the same enemy. France is expected to follow suit within the next few hours.
From the Meadowbrook on the Newark-Pompton Turnpike, Route 23 at Cedar Grove, New Jersey, we bring you the music of Count Basie and his orchestra. And the first number, the 1 o'clock jump.
Hi, this is Gary Moore. All of those voices were broadcast during a few nervous months of the summer of 1939. In those last years of peace, I think radio perfected its talent for bridging great distances with the flick of a switch. We learned to bring in Moscow, Chongqing, South America, even the Steel Pier at Atlantic City, right on cue. Remember all those nostalgic ballrooms of the 30s and 40s? You could hear a band from Oat every 15 minutes all night long, it seemed. And I might add that Benny Goodman was at his absolute zenith around 1939, and there was some first-rate music to be heard. And now, back to the control room at NBC. The voice is Ben Grauer.
I used to do a roundup, and we'd call in 8 or 10 capitals of the world. We were beginning to have a staff in each of the great cities. Full-time, not stringers. Now, I got word just before I went on that there was something wrong with the Madrid circuit and that we would go Paris and then London. So I introduced Paris, and Paris was on. As I was sitting there and my head was down, musing and listening to what was coming from Paris while with the other ear I was listening to London, upcoming London, I heard a voice say, "Look up, Ben." And there was the director of the program in behind the glass booth with a piece of paper written on it, "Spain," and signaled me, not London, Spain. When we finished the show, I suddenly said, "Oh, who said look up, Ben? What was all that?" He said, "With 30 seconds to go, London coming, RCA said they now have the Madrid circuit, and I wanted to get it fast before we lose it. I rapped on the glass, and you didn't respond. You couldn't hear me. I thought maybe you're plugged into London. So I said, 'Hey, Fred Bate, I think Ben is plugged into you. Tell him to look up.'" So Jack's voice went out to London, 3,000 miles. Bates said, "Hey, look up, Ben," came back to me 3,000 miles, and I looked up 6 feet into the director's eye.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin. Moscow, Germany, and Russia today signed a non-aggression pact. They have agreed that neither country would declare war against one another and that neither one would come to the aid of a third party in case either nation was attacked.
No amount of swing and jive and gags and rhythm could drown out for long the news from Europe. Suddenly, it was September 1st, 1939.
Danzig, Wirtschaftlich zu vernichten. Dass dann Deutschland nicht mehr länger untätig zusehen könnte.
We interrupt this broadcast of Adolf Hitler's speech just momentarily to report a dispatch from Paris which says that Premier Daladier of France has now called the French Council of Ministers for an emergency meeting which is to take place just 10 minutes from now at 5:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
Provokationen begangen. Meine Friedensliebe und meine endlose Langmut soll man nicht mit Schwäche oder gar mit Feigheit verwechseln.
No one should confuse my patience with cowardice. Once again, we interrupt very briefly this talk by Chancellor Hitler to announce that in London, Parliament has been summoned to meet at 6 p.m. in London, which is 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time today.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note. This country is at war with Germany.
Those fabulous Dorseys.
Tommy Dorsey, the orchestra, blow the dust off a great old favorite, Song of India.
We interrupt our regular program to bring you a special broadcast. We take you now to Montevideo, Uruguay.
We have just seen the Grass B explode 5 miles from the coast. The ship has been scuttled.
The Grass Bay, when it was scuttled down in Montevideo, there was only one line from Montevideo to Buenos Aires, and we happened to get that line first, and we had a fella just reading the telephone directory on it all day.
NBC's news and special events director was Abe Schechter, a man of great determination despite his quiet voice. The date was 2 weeks before Christmas, 1939.
Actually, we didn't even have a man in Uruguay. We didn't know it was coming in there, and we got hold of a man who was working at the so-called American Club, and we hired him and made him a reporter. And then we told him to hire anybody that could talk English. We didn't want the opposition to get a hold of anybody to be able to do a report. He found four or five fellows who talked English, and he hired them. All of them, hired them all. And he reported back that it was pretty hard to see way out to sea, 4 or 5 miles into the harbor and so on. We asked him if there was any kind of a tall place where he could get a better view. And came back, he said, yeah, there's a lighthouse. But the fellow wants $250 or something for us to use it to go up there. So we figured if we pay $250, the opposition might pay $350. So we said, does he want to sell it? So we bought the lighthouse for $1,000. We got rid of it for $300 the day after the broadcast. But they went up there and they could see way out into the bay, so they could give us a description.
Moving. Growing from side to side. There goes another explosion. The after turret has gone up. She's going down. She's going down by the stern. The stern is completely underwater. Flames are still shooting up into the air. Smoke.
Well, the Graf Spee went down in only 3 minutes after the crew scuttled her. But a personal telegram from President Roosevelt to NBC made the cost of the lines and the lighthouse seem insignificant.
Good evening, and to the West Coast. To this side, good morning. Presenting a program of music by Count Basie, the Count of Swing. This program of ultra-modern rhythms comes to you from the Savoy Ballroom, known as the home of Happy Feet. Count Basie, the singing of Willie Holiday and James Rushing is heard here nightly.
I remember 1940 as a year of terrible battles inside the broadcasting industry. Let's take recordings, for instance. Now, all during the 30s, we had to identify each record as a recording or an electrical transcription. And this carried such a stigma for the networks that delayed broadcast of any kind was extremely rare. Now, that all changed in 1940 when the FCC relaxed the rules about identification. In 1941, ASCAP boycotted the stations. Money was at the root of this altercation. But for a whole season, all you could hear was music in the public domain. Then the following year, the musicians went on strike against the record companies. So all you could hear was vocals with a vocal backing.
In my arms, ain't I never gonna get a girl in my arms. In my arms, in my arms.
But these were small wars, of course, compared to what was going on in Europe. I remember so well a torrent of voices pleading, demanding, and castigating our involvement in what was still, after all, a foreign war. Now, here is Fulton Lewis, Jr., speaking for the anti-interventionists.
It appears tonight that the war in Europe is becoming more of a headache than it is a boon to the aviation industry in the United States, which expected such tremendous help from that war, and is becoming such a headache. And Secretary Morgenthau announced today that the federal government will have to step in to make sure that the plane orders for France and England are not allowed to interfere with the supply of airplanes for our own Army and Navy and commercial airlines. They will have to be served first of all. After that, the rest of the engines that are turned out can be used in planes for England or France or Timbuktu or any other country.
The date on that one is 1940. I recall hearing Edward R. Murrow, also in 1940, on the air, live, during the Battle of Britain.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance. One single beam sweeping the sky above me now.
How touched we were, and how moved by the voice of Churchill.
Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for a thousand years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
And the famous Christmas message of Princess Elizabeth.
My sister is by my side, and we are both going to say good night to you. Come on, Margaret. Good night, children. Good night, and good luck to you all.
And smiled at me, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
Nevertheless, the early 40s were wonderful years for radio. All of the big nighttime comedy shows were on, and CBS was producing its very finest dramatic shows. I myself was doing something called Club Matinee in Chicago, and we had a variety format with rapid sketches and jokes, the whole marvelous thing conceived in style by its star, Ransom Sherman. Any real radio buff remembers Ransom until this day. A really literate, gentle, funny fellow. So literate that the show was unsponsored for 8 full years. Then I came to New York to do something called Anything Goes, which was the same kind of show, until someone at NBC put me on the air with Jimmy Durante. We both thought we were mismatched. You know, different ages, different styles. But something must have been right, because Durante and Moore was on for 5 years.
Well, Jimmy, no matter what anybody tells you, you go right on wearing that suit.
A suggestion I sustain.
Hmm?
Why, even Lucius Beebe refers to me as the Bum Brummel of Broadway. But my fame has already reached the OPA. They called me to Washington for a consultation on women's clothes. On the train, I met Elmer Davis, Umbriago, Senator Pepper, Umbriago, Governor Bricker, and Umbriago.
Who's Umbriago?
He was the conductor. He went through the train yelling, change for Elizabeth, change for Elizabeth. And would you believe it, Gary? I chipped in a quarter and I didn't even know the girl.
That was Jimmy's style. Somewhere in the midst of all the excitement, we had an election. And still another voice was heard on the already crowded airwaves.
One man rule always leads to the road to war. If you re-elect him, you may expect war in April 1941.
Join me in this crusade to save free America. Help, help. Please help us in this crusade. Become aroused.
This was Wendell Willkie, who lost to President Roosevelt's third term.
I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign war.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
When the Japanese planes attacked Pearl Harbor, it was radio that shocked the nation and flashed the news to every city and town within minutes after the attack began. The following day, 60 million people heard the president speak to Congress and to the nation.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
For the first year of the war, radio was a carrier of bad news. Radio seemed to reinforce the distance and the loneliness and the sense of disaster as we gave up one spot after another with names we barely recognized. Places like Luzon and Bataan and Corregidor.
This is Lieutenant General J.M. Wainwright. Subject, surrender. Yesterday, I tendered to Lieutenant General Conway, the Commander-in-Chief of the Imperial Japanese Forces in the Philippines, the surrender of the four harbor defense forts of Manila Bay.
And I can't praise too highly the war correspondents, men like Murrow and Eric Severide and Larry Lesueur and Bob Trout, and the commentators who did their utmost to interpret to the American people a war that for a while seemed overwhelming. They were eloquent men, and above all, they wrote brilliantly. One voice in particular had a reassuring sound, even in 1942.
The Office of War Information presents its director, Elmer Davis, in his weekly report to the American people at home and to America's fighting forces overseas.
We've had another week of air war, the greatest air war that the world has yet seen, and its scale is still increasing. For 6 days and nights, American and British bombers based in England have been steadily pounding northwestern Germany. And the cities on the Ruhr seem to be in worse shape now than was any city in England after the Blitz of 2 years ago last winter. It's not necessary to take too literally the stories from Switzerland that 4 or 5 million people are moving out of the Ruhr to realize that this industrial district is not what it used to be.
It's the old Professor K. Kaiser.
Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition and we'll all stay free.
You know, during the First War, radio was a primitive tool that kept the ships in touch with the shore and vice versa. In the interim between the wars, it had mushroomed into a roaring entertainment industry, a marketing and sales empire, and a news machine that amazed even those who worked for it. As a morale builder, it was unbeatable, and more often than not, it was set to music.